Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Today we are joined by a fellow named Gary Capone. He goes to the same church as I do over at St. John the Evangelist in Waynesboro. He magically appeared at the very beginning of my conversion, where I was bartending, and him and about 20 other Catholic men came bursting through the door, and I asked them who they were. They said, well, they're a Catholic men's group. I said, you know what? I literally decided just the other day that I want to be a Catholic man. And he had a spare ticket to bring me to Steubenville and drove me up himself. So magically appeared at the very beginning of my conversion. He's a fount of all sorts of knowledge and wisdom, and I'm pleased to have him on the show. Today we're talking about the massive rise in anxiety and depression and the Catholic response to it. So he's discussing living life in the age of anxiety and depression. So, Gary, thanks for joining me today. I'm looking forward to the conversation. If you just want to fill us in a little bit about how you became passionate about talking about this subject.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jake. I appreciate being included in the podcast, and certainly appreciate our relationship over the years. You've certainly strengthened my faith as well. So anxiety and depression is something that has affected my family. Most of my family members have, some form of anxiety, depression. A number of them also have alcoholism and addiction as part of our family. And I think a lot of that is driven by the anxiety, in particular social anxiety, but that is something that I grew up with and saw, I've experienced. And I've seen in, as I said, my family, but then as I progressed, I was a catechist for high school students and saw a number of them dealing with anxiety and depression. And the more that that broadened, I saw more of my friends and people I knew, it became something that I could see how isolated and how alone and how overwhelming these can be for individuals. And so I started, sharing my experience with people and started, giving talks on this. So I've talked to different parishes, youth conferences, different youth classes, and tried to share both my experience and what I've learned more broadly about the topic, because I think a lot of people really need help. I think this is an age of anxiety and depression, almost uniquely in our history. Certainly there have been times where that's existed in other societies and times, but right now we're being afflicted by this in a really, particular way, and it is widespread. As I learned about the topic, because once I started sharing my story, at retreats and things of that nature, I wanted to learn more. A few stats that I think are kind of shocking. With the youth, 1 in 3 adolescents have an anxiety disorder. 1 in 7 teens will experience a major depressive episode this year. And 1 in 6 teens seriously consider suicide at some point during their teenage years. Those stats, it's absolutely widespread and affecting them in horrible ways. With adults, it's every bit as bad, if not worse. 40 million people have an anxiety disorder. That's 20% of our country. 1/3 of adults have anxiety and depressive symptoms. And if you look at the 18 to 24 age bracket, that rises to half.
Wow.
Of all the people in that age group have anxiety and depressive symptoms. And then the what may be the most tragic, between 2000 and 2020, a 20-year period, 800,000 people in the U.S. committed suicide. And that's an average of 40,000 a year. But we're now at a point where we're topping 50,000 a year are committing suicide. That is absolutely staggering to me. And it's something that, if I can help someone by sharing my struggles, I want to do that as much as I can. And when we look at this, a few other things that have come up that I've seen, you go back to the stats I have are from 1940 to now. So in 1940, the US had 30,000 medical professionals that specialized in mental health. Today, we have a 500,000. In 1940, there were no medications to treat mental health. Today, we have at least 24 drugs that can help mental health problems. And yet, the problems that we're seeing are getting worse. So the number of people that are afflicted by this, even though we have more people treating it and more treatments available, the problem's getting worse. So this is something that's completely widespread, and I can, and as we get into this, share a little of the, the darkness that I've experienced. I want people to know that that darkness and isolation, they're not alone. It just feels that way, and it feels like it'll never end, and it feels hopeless. And that is not reality. That is an absolute lie, but that feeling is overwhelming. So all of that has contributed to why I was excited when you invited me to talk with you and your audience.
Well, their stats are pretty sobering right there. I mean, one in three adolescents having an anxiety depression or a disorder. That's pretty serious. Then you hear, you quoted some others like one third of adults with anxiety and depression symptoms. But when you got to the suicide statistics, that's where things I think are just absolutely incredibly tragic. So between 2000 and 2020, 800,000 people, that's more than the population of North Dakota. So imagine if we wiped out the entire population of a state. That's the level of the problem that we have just in the last 20 years. So yeah, I'm glad we're talking about this one. And it goes fairly unnoticed. I forget who it was who said the vast majority of people live quiet lives of desperation. Well, we're not going to make it quiet anymore. So I'm glad we're discussing this. What do you see as the biggest causes? I mean, there's a few points in history, as you've said, where people dealt with this problem as keenly. And I think if somebody was just observing from afar, if we have the Martian on a spaceship, he would never have guessed that today, when we have everything we can possibly imagine. We have air conditioning and food, and we have entertainment, and we have healthcare. We have safety. We have professional police. We at least in the United States haven't had a war on our continent for how long? For generations, and yet we're the ones with the most massive amounts of anxiety and depression. So, what is going on?
Well, there are a number of causes. One of the biggest contributors you alluded to, and that is we have everything. Now, I'm not saying there aren't people that have financial problems and people that are struggling with basic needs. We certainly have that in our country, but a huge number of the people with the anxiety and depression that is so rampant pretty much have everything they could possibly want taken care of. And I think this, we can go back to Solomon and in Ecclesiastes. This is one of my greatest quotes from scripture. Solomon speaking, I said to my heart, come now, let me try you with pleasure and with the enjoyment of good things. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Solomon, the wisest man ever, said, can I possibly satisfy every desire that I have in terms of comfort and pleasure and power and achievement, and sought to do that to the extreme. And what he found was it was completely empty. And that is one of the lies that exist in our society today. And that is the pursuit of pleasure and comfort is the ultimate good. And that's a lie. The pursuit of pleasure and comfort lead to dissatisfaction. It leads to addiction. You will never be satisfied. One of the, you know, I've had certain successes. I've had certain failures in my life, but I've had a number of successes. And a lot of those successes afterwards, there's a letdown. One of the things I find fascinating, I don't have a PhD. I have two bachelor's degrees, but there is a very common phenomenon among PhDs of they complete their PhD, they get it, and then all of a sudden they're immediately followed with a period of depression because there was such a motivation of I have to get to this end, and when I get to this achievement, I'll be satisfied. And that satisfaction doesn't come. So I think a lot of it is what you referred to as we have everything and we think that's enough, but it isn't. One of the biggest things I think that's a factor is the decline of the family and the decline of marriage, that we don't have those close-knit relationships in our families, that marriages are breaking up, that it used to be the family was the extended family. You had dozens and dozens of close family members, and then it became the nuclear family, and now we're focused on the individual. So the increase in divorce, the increase of, you know, the use of daycare, you know, children are growing up where they're spending more time away from their parents than with their parents. All of this, I think, is contributing. One of the biggest factors, I think, is pornography and the effects of that. Pornography is absolutely a scourge in our society. It corrupts us. It is so addictive. It distorts our entire thought process and how we view pleasure, both sexual and beyond that. And it is so prevalent that almost everyone is touched by it. Now, does everyone go to a pornographic site and watch videos all night long? No. But there are very few movies and TV shows that are geared towards adults that don't have at least some form of pornography in them. And so we are all exposed to this if we consume any media at all. And then you get into the promiscuity and sexual abuse that, you know, is rampant in our society. Our society is struggling with financial problems that we crave more and more. We've just gone through a bout of inflation, and there are a lot of people that are struggling, thinking they should have it all. They should have that pleasure, that comfort, whatever they want. They're owed that. And not having it can either be, you know, extremely difficult if it's a basic need, or, you know, it's a dissatisfaction because of something they feel entitled to. And that feeling of entitlement is pervasive in our society. I think we have too much choice. The number of choices that we have. I did my grocery shopping this weekend, and the number of choices that you have to make just in picking out individual items is staggering. And I think we get exhausted with just the overwhelming amount of choice that we have in our society, and don't realize what a burden that puts on us and how difficult it is. We have a lack of friendships. One of the statistics I ran into is the average man a generation or two ago had 2 to 3 good friends. Today, the average man has 1, and many men have no friends. That's a problem. Women, a little higher on that scale, but they have less friends than they did a generation ago as well. And without those close friendships and without the family relationships, you know, we have a problem. And then you've got the spiritual side. There has been just an explosion of people seeking spiritual in the wrong place. Satanism, occult practices, witchcraft, other things like that have become widespread. They're much more public because they're generally accepted by a large part of our society. And if you look at scripture, you know, one of the things that you know, reading the Old Testament, anytime you see the phrase, they did evil in the sight of the Lord, the next chapter is never good for those people. And it's, you know, our society, I think, is reaping some of, you know, that, you know, we're opening our society up to attacks of the enemy. The enemy wants to torture and destroy us as much as possible. And he is completely malicious, far more than we can imagine. And by opening that up in our society with the widespread, you know, grave sins of things like abortion that are just rampant, we're opening ourselves up. And then the last piece is so many people have fallen away from the faith and don't see sin as the horror that it is, that they've turned away from God. And if you don't have trust in God, it makes hard times unbelievably difficult. You put all of this stuff together and we've just set ourselves up for attack from the enemy and having nothing around us to support us. And none of us are strong enough alone. And I think that that anxiety and depression, it wells up in us. We know something's wrong and we can't identify it, but that's where it manifests, is in that anxiety and depression.
Well, I think you laid out a number of good causes. So let's kind of dig into a few of those. A few things, as you mentioned, those I was thinking of was they've done some studies on kids and they've looked at the effect on all sorts of things like behavior, educational achievement, criminality later, general mental health, etc. And the effect of divorce on a child is almost identical to the effect of the death of one of their parents. So we can't underrate just how emotionally, psychologically damaging that is. And the amount of people from broken homes is staggering. I think that we take it for granted, but when we put it in perspective that when you meet somebody who says, I had my dad die when I was, say, 9 years old, we immediately understand how difficult their life would be. I think we need to have that same reflex reaction when you hear my parents divorced when I was 9 years old or something, because the effect is the same, at least for in the average. I'm sure some people are able to deal with these things differently. The other thing you brought up, which I think is interesting, is pornography. And, you know, Thomas Aquinas and other saints, it's pretty much unanimous, say that of all sins, it seems that lust darkens the intellect the most. And interestingly, Aquinas, when he lays out a few remedies for grief and sorrow, he says contemplation of truth is one of them. So if you've caused yourself to contemplate all things which are evil, then the truth is not going to lay hold to your intellect in the way it ought to. And you're not going to be able to derive joy from contemplating the truth. And ultimately in heaven with the beatific vision, that's where we get to see God as God. It's the use of our intellect, our will. It's a full connection with our creator. And we can get pieces of that here on earth in contemplating the truth of God and knowing the truth of the things in the created order. And that's directly damaged by things like pornography. Another thing that Aquinas offers as a remedy for sorrow is he says, hey, you know, why don't you just drink some wine? And it's funny because in our culture, we're so saturated with pleasures. We're so saturated with enjoyment already that has become, if anything, bad advice. If you're somebody who sees this as just a celebratory thing, if you're somebody who can't feast on the daily, then yeah, maybe it is the remedy for sorrow to do something that's enjoyable. But we've lost the ability to exercise that also because we're already full. A little bit more whatever is not going to help us at this point. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, I tried to remember all four that he offers, but another is friendship. And that's been destroyed. He says, if you're feeling low, why don't you bring some friends around. And I did remember the fourth. It's take a bath. And I don't know if we that one directly relates, but I guess Satan hasn't gotten around to attack bathing. So it really has torpedoed at least three of the four that Aquinas would say. And you brought up another interesting one, which is choice. There was a study a long time ago, it's pretty famous, where they went into grocery stores and they set up tables and they offered different jams for people to taste with crackers. And at the end, they said, hey, how satisfied are you with the jam that you ended up purchasing after you tried them? And what they were looking at was the satisfaction and it correlating to the number of potential jams. And they found out that if you offer somebody one jam and then they're like, yeah, all right, cool. Yeah, I liked it. I'll give it a six. If you offer them two, three, four jams, it goes up. They're more happy in general with actually all of the jams that they taste. And once you go past six, people get confused and upset and unhappy with their jam. The jam remains constant, but the number of choices that people are being presented change. And the peak seems to be about six. So anything past that just creates anxiety and stress and makes you unhappy. And I think that's a pretty interesting finding in social science. You know, the last thing I'll kind of point out before we kind of move along, I think you did a good job outlining the many, many potential causes of this culture of anxiety and depression. But the other thing I want to point out, and I think I have in other podcasts, is Solomon's use of under the sun again and again and again. And it's almost irritating how many times he writes that. And you wonder, why is he doing it? Why is he always giving this little proviso under the sun? And, you know, I've suggested that, well maybe he's showing that we should be looking somewhere else. He's saying, hey, underneath the sun, that is within the natural order or just here on earth, everything is ultimately meaningless if that's what we're grasping at, with the implication that, well, maybe we need to be looking for something beyond just the natural order, something over and above the sun, something past just the light of what we can naturally see and find and come to enjoy, ultimately God himself. So I think that that's something that our culture is not embracing. It does want to look only in the place which Solomon crossed off for us. It just wants to look under the sun.
You mentioned Aquinas a couple times, and going back to the discussion of pornography and the darkening of the intellect, one of the things that I love and really has impacted how I look at myself and the world is how Aquinas explains how we're supposed to think and how we would have thought prior to the fall. And that is, you have a thought in your imagination. Your intellect assesses that thought for whether it is good or bad. If it is good, your will makes a choice of willing to do it or not, you know, based on other options. If it's bad, it wills not to do it. And then your desire follows from doing what is good versus the complete opposite of what the fall has kind of led to us. And that is, we feel a desire in our passions. That desire, you know, impacts our imagination and attacks our will and weakens our will, to where our will says, I desire this too much, I need to have it. At which point our will then starts attacking our intellect and saying, I want this so much, it must be good. And our intellect then twists that so that we can't see truth and chooses it as a good because it satisfies that desire that has been corrupted and given too much control. If we were thinking the way we're supposed to think, to where our passions are for doing what is good that we have willed based on our intellect choosing that good thing, we would have joy in whatever we did because it is good. And, you know, it was Bishop Barron that, you know, in his Catholicism series talks about Christ on the cross being the happiest person that had ever been on Earth. And he describes that because it is so contrary to what we would consider happy. Because on the cross, he was in the absolute extreme of agony that a human could experience. And in his humanity, he was experiencing the greatest agony, you know, essentially possible. And yet he was doing the will of his Father, which was the ultimate good. And therefore, because he was perfectly aligned with that right thought process, he was filled with some form of joy at being on the cross. And which is hard to kind of comprehend how he could be in that extreme pain and be filled with joy at the same time. And yet he was. And actually, you know, I can, you know, relate to that on a much lesser scale. I mean, I used to, you know, do triathlons and marathons. One of the most painful times I ever felt was at the end of a marathon. And there was a extreme pain and yet a joy of finishing. And, you know, how insignificant that is compared to Christ on the cross. But that's my experience of that, you know, merging of joy and pain at the same time. When my daughter was born, due to working second shift or night shift and those kind of things, I went, I don't know, 42 hours without sleeping, 24 hours without eating. You know, I hurt, but all I wanted to do was hold her. And my love for her made that a joyous time when I was aching. And I think the more that we feed that pleasure center in our brain, the more we pursue pleasure, like you said, the more it darkens the intellect to where we think pleasure, you know, if we're not feeling pleasure, then we're missing something. And pleasure is not the ultimate end. There is a joy that is so much greater. And that, you know, pornography, you know, and so many other things are leading us down that path of, if it feels good, it must be good. And the further down the path you get, like you said, it darkens the intellect and you can't make good choices and you end up with addictions and other, you know, all kinds of other problems that lead to the anxiety and depression that's so rampant.
Yeah. I like that you described it exactly and very clearly, how Aquinas sees that and kind of brought in the cross. The cross really is the very opposite of what happened in the tree in the garden. You know, in the cross, it's the logos, the reason, the intelligence, the intelligibility comes to do the will of the Father, even to the subjection of his body to terrible humiliation and punishment and death. Whereas in the tree of the garden, it looks like a delight to the eyes, and then it was desired, and then it reworked what they believed God said. So it started with the body, and then that moved the will, and then it caused the reason to just rewrite what it ought to have known. That's the exact opposite of what Christ did, and that's also the inversion of what makes us happy.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So you've come to find this not just by reading dusty old books, but instead over your entire life. So I kind of want to open it up to hearing a bit of your story as much as you want to offer here, and show us how this played out in your life.
Yeah, this is the part that is a little more difficult, because there's no way to go through this without sharing things that are personal and in some cases, you know, embarrassing, because I haven't lived the way I should have lived. But anxiety has been part of my life. And, you know, so has depression. And just my story on how that came about. A little background. You know, first grade, I had a teacher that I don't understand why she was a teacher. She just, everything that I can piece together is she must have just hated kids. So I was a high energy, probably would be labeled ADHD today, probably would have been put on drugs, you know, to control me. But I was just, you know, a high energy, intelligent boy who wanted to do things. My first grade teacher to deal with me tied me to the chair and taped my mouth and put me in the back of the room. So for first grade, I didn't learn anything and really didn't have a good experience in school. I didn't really learn to read until the end of second grade, beginning of third grade. So I was remedial and in school. And yet my parents kept telling me I was intelligent. They thought, you know, they saw me as intelligent. The school system saw me as kind of a, you know, remedial lost cause. And fortunately, my parents, after fourth grade and then after fifth grade, changed schools both times. And every time they changed schools, they moved me from being at the lowest level of everything to middle level and then to the highest, you know, level, and just said, well, this is where he should be placed. He's doing really well and, you know, should be at this higher level. And in those 2 years, I went from being remedial, one of the, you know, furthest behind in the school, to all of a sudden in sixth and seventh grade, you know, I was one of the smartest kids in my school and excelling, having been not very good at school all, and all of a sudden having a lot of achievement, I became more than a little obnoxious, and sought that success. And when I got to high school, went to a very competitive all-boy Catholic high school, and I excelled and loved the competition. And again, that fed that pride and that drive. I was on the debate team. We, you know, competed nationally, did very well in that. I had lots of success in that. And to give you an idea of the, you know, kind of competitiveness and drive that I had, you know, we had senior year, the senior class had a, you know, the things that they vote most likely to, I was voted most likely to argue with God and win. so it, to give you a little insight in my personality at that time, that's not something I'm proud of today. It's just, it is what the picture was. So then I, you know, went to college, went to a, you know, very good school. I got two degrees at the same time, excelled in that. It wasn't enough. I needed more. I constantly put myself in positions for more challenge. I got into exercising and endurance sports, triathlons and marathons, and kept pushing myself to do more. That wasn't enough. At different times of my life, I've become addicted to video games very easily. And, you know, at the same time through this, when I got to college, I started drinking, and coming from a family with a lot of alcoholics in it, I took to that very well. It didn't take very long before I was drinking excessively. I think it took weeks, and that stayed with me for years and years. And that didn't satisfy. There were a number of things that, you know, I was pursuing something to satisfy me, and they just left me more and more empty. At the same time, when I got to college, it was a very secular, liberal college. I went to Mass, I think, once or twice in 4 years there. When I came home, I went to Mass. My father had a rule, go to Mass every weekend, had to go. But when I was at college, you know, it was non-existent, but never thought of myself as not being Catholic. You know, the Catholic in name only, was the direction I was going. And then when I got out of college, started my career, I drifted in and out of the Catholic Church. There were times where it's like, oh, I'm not doing it right. I've got to get back. I've got to get on the right path. And I would do that for a while and then drift away again. And each time I would drift further and further away and was more and more empty, you know, with what I went through. And it just, you know, continued to get worse. Now there were some good moments in there. I met my wife, and we got married. We had my daughter, our daughter, it wasn't just mine, obviously, we had, our daughter, and there were some things that were very good. And, you know, with a daughter, I could remember my father made sure we went to church. That kind of brought me back to start going to Mass. But I wasn't, yeah, I wasn't invested in my faith at that point. In 2005, I started a business. I had always wanted to own my own business and started that. It was a recruiting business. I'd had some experience in that industry and got started. We were starting to have success, grew a team. Things were growing, it were going really well. And 2008 hit. And every client that we had froze hiring for longer than I had money in the bank. And it's amazing when you have a payroll of five or six people, how fast money goes out the door. That financially wiped me out. I was borrowing to cover payroll, maxed out credit cards, maxed out my line of credit, everything that I had completely financially wiped out. And then, through the midst of this, my wife at some point, told me that I had to shut down the business and quit hemorrhaging cash or she was leaving. And at the same time, we had a trip planned to go to a Caribbean island that her parents were going to take us on a vacation, because they wanted to spend time with us and their granddaughter. And I was looking forward to that. And my wife told me that she was dreading the vacation because it meant spending a week with me. And I could see my marriage falling apart. I was failing my wife. I was failing my daughter. And if I was failing my daughter, I was failing as a father, and I was failing in my career. Husband, father, career, the three things that were most important to me, I was failing dismally at all three of those. I was drinking a lot, and was absolutely in a point of complete darkness. So the anxiety, ever present. The depression, never lifted. And the thoughts of suicide were there every minute of every waking day. And I can't tell you how many times I would be in a situation of, oh, I'm walking down the street and there's a truck. I could just take I could fall to the side and this would be over. Or things of that nature where just here's a moment in life and in 5 seconds, I could be gone and all this pain would go away. And that thought was there, which I've, you know, eventually learned was the voice of the enemy. You know, the devil is there to corrupt us, to torment us. And that voice, which sounded like my thoughts, constantly there of, you can end this now. You failed at everything. You can make the pain stop right now. Two things really got me through that. One, I knew that it would hurt my daughter and probably hurt my wife far more if I did that than if I persevered. But I knew it would hurt my daughter tremendously. And I knew that that wouldn't end the pain. You know, I know that, you know, suicide is, you know, often driven by mental health, and I have, you know, I really desire that the souls of those who have committed suicide, that it wasn't their full decision to separate from God forever, and that many of them hopefully end up in a place of heaven. Hopefully they end up in a place far higher than me in heaven. I would love, you know, I want that for them. Mm-hmm. But there was a fear in me of, I make this choice, it's an eternal choice. And that fear helped me persevere. And sometimes you have to hang on to whatever you're hanging on to, you have to hold on to it through these times of difficulty. So I was going through this, and finally I reached a point where I was completely broken. And the date was actually June 17th, 2009. I completely gave up. I was in my home office. I didn't know what to do. I was separated from God. All I could think of is, I want this to end. And I got on my knees and I prayed to God, and it was, a fairly, dumb prayer of, hey, God, I have no clue what to do. I've been trying to drive my life all my life and to follow my plan. I've clearly, that the plan isn't working. I don't know what your plan is. It can't be this bad.
Yeah.
Just show me what to do. And I got up off of my knees, in my basement. It's an unfinished basement at my desk. So kind of, not terrible, but not, plenty of spiders and things like that. Sat back down and nothing happened. And I sat there and it was like, the life plan manual did not drop out of the sky on the desk and open up to page one of just do this. And I was looking for something, and I started, as I sat there and completely blank of nothing but depression, anxiety, and no idea what to do, nothing happened. And I was getting angry at God. It's like, I give up. Show me something. Give me a path. And so finally, after a period of time, I said, okay, God is not going to speak to me. He's not going to show this to me, for whatever reason. I have to go find it. I know there are some saints that, and I only knew a few saints at that point in time. It's like, St. Peter, the path of first pope, probably not an option for me. Paul, I'm not going to go convert all the Gentiles. Francis, vow of poverty and whatever else he did. I have a family. I can't leave them. I'm going to look up the saint of the day, and maybe there's someone there that can help me. So I Googled saint of the day. And the reason I know the date of this is because of the feast day. The saint of the day was Saint Emily, which immediately I'm grasping for anything. My daughter's name is Emily. And wow, maybe this is a sign. I'll take it as a sign. I need something. This is God telling me this is important. I read the bio, and Saint Emily lived in France in I think it was the 1700s. She was a nun, sister, a religious sister that founded a religious community that opened schools for peasant children in rural France in the 1700s. And I'm looking at this and like, I'm not French. I'm not a woman. I'm not a religious. I'm not going to open a bunch of schools for peasant children in rural France. God, this is your plan for me? There's nothing here. And again, I'm getting more and more angry. It's like, God, you got to give me something. You don't owe me anything, but I need something. And I need something now. And I reread the biography. It was only a long paragraph. And the religious order triggered something. And immediately I Googled my grade school that I went to at sixth through eighth grade. And Sure enough, the order that she founded was the order that ran my grade school and that got me from that remedial stage in my early elementary to middle school, where I excelled and propelled me in my academic career. And, you know, although I had a failed business and was financially wiped out at this point, had led me to a number of successes. And I realized that what God was telling me wasn't, here's what I'm going to do for you now. I had this inspiration of God saying, don't you see, I sent you help 300 years ago so that when you needed it 20 years ago or whatever it was, 25 years ago, you would, that help would be there for you. And at that moment, everything turned of, I see it as a true, miracle of a signal grace that God gave me of just trust me. The anxiety and depression continued. The thoughts of suicide continued, but all of a sudden they didn't have nearly the strength. I had some trust in God. I decided to resolve to follow and trust in him. And times were tough for several years. There was one month that on the 30th of the month, I didn't have enough money. I was, $300 short to pay my mortgage on the 30th of the month. It was a 31-day month. On the 31st day, I was doing some consulting work here and there. I got a $350 order that paid up front. And $350 went into my account, and I paid my mortgage that day with $50 left in my bank account. And I got through. And the number of times that God just kind of spoon-fed me the minimum that I absolutely needed over that couple-year period is absolutely staggering. And I learned to trust him. Not perfectly. I'm still a mess at times and, still want to pursue my plan and still have that prideful desire of doing it myself, of having achievement that I've done. I haven't done anything. It's all God, but I have a short memory at times. But he turned things completely around in that moment of just showing me that he sent me help long before my grandparents were born, and that he sent me help at so many different times. So from that day onward, I decided to read the saint of the day, that, hey, I want to know every saint out there, and I never will know all of them, but wanted to know as many saints as I possibly could. And through the years, have gotten to know so many saints that can help us in these times of darkness. There's one in particular that really stands out for me, and that is Saint Noel Chabanel, which is not a well-known saint. He was one of the North American martyrs, which, a lot of people have heard of them, but generally Noel Chabanel isn't one of the top names of them that comes to mind, if people have even heard of him. But he was French. He was from the nobility, raised in a very affluent lifestyle, had the best education, incredibly smart. There wasn't a subject he studied that he didn't excel at, and learned a number of languages very easily. Learning languages was, it just came natural to him. And he joined the Jesuits and wanted to be a missionary to North America, and was sent to North America to be a missionary. He gets there and complete culture shock of living in a austere environment in the woods, sleeping on the ground, not having the comforts, not having servants. Everything that he had lived with his whole life was gone. the, you know, his writings, he, you know, some of his letters, he talks about, he absolutely abhorred the food of the Native Americans. He, you know, found their look to be, you know, just unattractive to him. And he thought that they all smelled incredibly foul. I mean, he just didn't like anything or the people that he was there to be a missionary to. And one of the things that was hardest for him was he couldn't learn the native languages. All of his other Jesuit brothers that came to North America seemed to pick up the languages easily, and he couldn't. And all of a sudden, he went from being the guy that school was easy and learning was easy to he couldn't learn anything. And this, he fell into this deep, dark depression that, you know, was unrelenting. But he kept working as a missionary. Then the first of the North American martyrs was killed. And the bishop called all of the missionaries and said, look, this is a lot more dangerous than we thought it was going to be, because, you know, that first martyr, like many of them, was brutally tortured and then killed. And he said, look, if you want to go back, you didn't realize this is kind of the environment that we're working in. Pray on it, discern whether you want to stay or you should go back, you know, to your native country. I don't know that they were all French. I think they were, but I don't know that for sure. But he spent a lot of time in contemplation and prayer and discerned that despite this being miserable for him, that this was the cross that Christ wanted him to carry. And he decided to stay. 2 years later, he was tortured and killed. And he is one of the martyrs. We don't know of anyone that he converted. As a missionary, you could look at his life of achievement as a complete and utter failure. But he sacrificed every desire, comfort, everything that he had for the people that were there. And his sacrifice and his martyrdom was for them. So even though he didn't catechize and teach and convert and baptize and do the things that a missionary is expected to do, there is a great success in his persevering through that darkness of depression. And, you know, it's a story that's important to me because you can be a saint in that struggle. Now, I'm not saying that you should, if you have depression or anxiety or another mental health illness, that you shouldn't seek help. Absolutely seek help. And we should talk about that a little bit as well. But in that struggle, there can be great holiness and sanctity. And that cross is a cross that when you realize, okay, I can carry this and I can carry this with Christ in his agony in the garden. I can carry this with Mary, Our Lady of Sorrows. Imagine the sorrow that Mary had fleeing Bethlehem, knowing that her son was being hunted to be killed and he would be killed at some point. Because, you know, Simeon revealed that, you know, in the temple, she mm-hmm. knew what was going to happen, at least to some degree. And she also knew she was leaving the couple dozen children behind that were going to be massacred and killed. I can't imagine the sorrow and depression and anxiety that Mary felt, knowing that she could do nothing to help those children. What person on earth besides Christ could love as much as Mary? And therefore, how much sorrow would she have felt in those moments? So looking at Mary looking at Christ, looking at a saint like Noel Chaboneau and many others that struggled with these things, and knowing that they're walking with me when these times occur, is really comforting to know that I'm not alone, and that there is a path to holiness. I can do things that are good and pleasing to God in this. I can be close to God, even though he feels as distant as possible. And yet I'm united with him on the cross in this. That is really important. People need to remember in those times of darkness.
You know, I like how you pointed out how God showed up in that moment. Oftentimes we imagine that, you know, God's just going to like just appear right in front of us. Like there he is, Jesus. And he's going to, you know, reach out with his hands and do something. And then all the sorrow is going to be taken away. And I mean, hey, he can do that. Maybe he has it sometimes in places, but you know, Aquinas and others, you know, bringing him up again, do use the analogy of, you know, God is to us kind of like an author is to a book. And if you want to know how the author loves his characters, what's from forming the story from the beginning and creating them and creating the other characters and placing them where they are placed. And that's how the author of all of reality loves us, by setting people to help us even 300 years in the past to found an order, to found a school, to you know, educate you and catechize you in the Catholic faith, to bring saints who you can unite your you know, your sorrows with as they united it with Christ. That's a unique way that God can love us, and by sending other people like the saints to pray and to show God's love to us and other people who are just in our lives too. And I like how you pointed out that the biblical characters didn't just have life set on easy mode, not at all. And there's a sense in which I'm sure they wouldn't want to. There's a fellow named Gary who, it's you, Gary, who brings up a wonderful analogy I use all the time. And that is, people who are big football fans would love nothing more than to play in the Super Bowl, even though they know that the other side can hurt them a lot. It's the passion for the game, and it's that love that makes you want to compete at the highest level. And I mean, I'm saying stuff that you've told me. I really like this analogy. That's how we ought to have. That's the same attitude we ought to have. And I think the saints certainly had, where that guy said, don't pull me out of the game, coach. Like, I'm competing at the highest level. I'm going against the forces of Satan, against the world, against the flesh, you know, the enemies of the church. And yeah, they can hurt me a lot. But you know what? I love my team. I love this game. I'm a fan of what God has set up for us to do and the work that we have to accomplish. And I want to play my part. That's a heroic thing. That gives a lot of meaning. And knowing that you have teammates, knowing that the pain that you experience is... that is having an impact, and it's having an impact that can ripple through hundreds of years. That's important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we go back and forth from feeling okay, feeling good, you know, those times of consolation, you know, the times of neutrality, but those times of desolation seem so dark and so hopeless, and we don't think we have the strength. Another saint that I discovered that I love is Saint Galgano. And he was, wealthy, might have been minor nobility in Italy. And he's right, you know, but just lived a life of debauchery. And he's riding his horse, you know, down a path, and gets knocked off of his horse. And there's Saint Michael. And St. Michael tells him with complete certainty that you are going to die in 1 year. And if you don't reform your life right now, you're going to hell. And Galgano's there, and he considers this, and he looks at St. Michael. He says, there is no way I can turn away from all of the sins that I am so addicted to, which obviously are, you know, not a direct quote from him, not the way he would have said it. But he said, I can't do this. It's impossible for me to do this. And he takes out his sword. He said, it would be easier for me to drive this sword through this stone. There's a big boulder there than it would be for me to repent and reform my life. And he takes his sword and drives it at the stone, and it drives all the way into the stone to the hilt. And you can go see this sword in the stone in Italy, in a church. I mean, there's a church built around it, of course, and go see this. And he did reform. That moment of Michael intervening and showing him the impossible is easy caused him to repent. He went and did penance for the next year, and true to what Michael said, he died a year later. And we believe him to be Saint Galgano, instead of the individual that had succumbed to virtually every sin. So no matter how impossible it seems to get out of whatever we are in, it's nothing for God. And we just have to have that trust. But that darkness is overwhelming. One of the things that I find, people in that darkness, they can talk to other people, and those people don't understand if they haven't experienced it. Or they're afraid to talk about it. And if I could, I'd like to share just a little of those experiences, because some of the people listening may not have experienced what people with anxiety and depression struggle with.
Yeah, paint the picture for us. And then I'd also like to hear a little bit about, for those people who have experienced it, what are some like steps that they can take? And then for those people who know people who are experiencing anxiety and depression, I'd love to hear like how they can help and what should they say to somebody. But yeah, please sketch out a little bit about what does this look like from the inside, anxiety and depression.
So anxiety, most people have an experience of fear. So, you know, there's a bear out there and he looks like he's going to attack you. We can relate to that, although very few of us have come face to face with a bear. We can imagine that kind of fear. What we have trouble with is the anxiety that doesn't necessarily have a discernible cause. Because if there's a bear out there, it's like, okay, I need to take these steps to eliminate these problems. And then it becomes a problem solving effort, and I need to get help from these people, or I need to do this. But when there's no discernible cause, it's really hard. But that anxiety is different from what I consider a fear like that. For me and for most people, although it varies from person to person, one of the strongest elements is just an overwhelming sense of nausea. You know, I feel sick, you know, want to throw up. And some people do. You know, I don't, but man, I feel like I want to. And in my case, I will eat to alleviate that, which is rare. Most people, they stop eating. I have a family member that he'll go days without eating because he feels so sick, and the idea of eating just makes him feel even more sick. And, you know, he'll almost starve himself because of the anxiety. Another aspect is an inability to sleep. Some people have trouble falling asleep. What I've found more common in the people I've talked to, and I don't know that this is more common broadly, and that is you can fall asleep, but you wake up in the middle of the night and you can't get back to sleep, which is really tough. One of the things that I did for that was I would, you know, if I would wake up in the middle of the night, I've got a rosary next to my bed. I would start, you know, I would grab that and say a Divine Mercy chaplet. And it would, you know, that would calm me and help me fall asleep. Not always. But I would, you know, I learned to pray that in the middle of the night when I was, you know, when I'd wake up at 1, 2, 3 in the morning, you know, completely wired and unable to go back to sleep. There's an agitatedness and a lot of energy. So you want to move and, you know, feel like the energy needs to get out. And yet there's a fatigue that's there that you don't want to do anything. And that's a complete contradiction. And yet they're both there. So nervous energy, but you feel like you have weights on you, that every movement takes incredible effort. And then the other piece is an inability to focus. I can remember a time at work where I was reading an email and it was a compound sentence, you know, not particularly long, but there were two phrases and an and in the middle. And I read the first phrase, read the second phrase. By the time I got to the second part of the second sentence, I had forgotten what the first one was. So I went back and reread the first one and then read the second one and had forgotten again. After doing this about 6 times, I realized what was going on and I couldn't even concentrate for the 10 seconds it took to read that sentence, to be able to keep 2 ideas from 1 sentence in my head for 10 sentence seconds. I couldn't do that. I was so agitated, and what I ended up doing was getting up, walking around. I got a drink of water, walked around the office and came back, and was able to read a sentence at that point. I was still at a high, you know, sense of anxiety. And what people don't understand if they haven't been afflicted by this is there may be no cause. One of the things that, you know, I've encountered a number of times, I've told people I've got anxiety, I'm having an anxiety attack. And I don't share this with a lot of people, with people close to me, but I've had a couple different family members say, well, what are you worried about? It's not that I'm worried about anything. I'm just having an anxiety attack. And they can't comprehend anxiety without a source of that fear. And that's one of the things that, what can you do if someone shares something like this? You know, just having someone say, that must be really difficult. Can I pray for you? Or I will pray for you. That, I can't tell you how powerful that is. I have a group of 4 guys that I'm close to. And when I have times of anxiety or depression, I send them a text. Hey, I'm in a really dark place right now. I'm struggling a lot. Would you pray for me? And within an hour, I'll have a text back from all 4 of them. Yep, praying for you. And it is amazing how fast I feel better.
Yeah, it's incredible. And you know, we mentioned earlier, I think possibly before we started recording, that of all of Job's friends that arrived, mm-hmm. none said, I'm going to pray for you.
Yep.
They really should. And what I've tried to do is when people ask me to pray, I mean, especially in Christian circles, this does happen. You know, people say, hey, could you pray for me for X, Y, and Z? And people say, yeah, I'll pray for you. But it's tough to get people to kind of believe that, like, yeah, I'm going to actually pray for you. So I've started saying, and I would invite people to adopt this, I'm going to pray the rosary for you this afternoon, or say, all right, I'm going to block off the next 10 minutes to pray for you, and give them an actual quantity of time that you're going to be praying for them, or a prayer that you will pray for them. So they know that it's not just a vague, yeah, I'll get around to it. It's an actually actionable thing that you mm-hmm. can do and that you're committing to do. And I think that that also helps you do it, because you just told them you're going to pray a full rosary for them. You don't want to have lied to them. You better get it done now.
Yep. And that, the fact that these guys respond to me, they don't respond with that specificity, but they are men that already, you know, men of prayer, and I know mm-hmm. them, and I can count on them. The other thing is, if that attack is from the enemy, and we go back to St. Ignatius of Loyola and his 14 rules for the discernment of spirits, one of his rules is bring to light the attacks of the enemy and he will flee. He is weak and he doesn't want to be called out. So when I'm struggling and I admit my weakness to four of my friends and I humble myself by saying, hey, I'm struggling and I can't carry this alone and I'm getting overwhelmed and I can't do it. I need help. Very often, if that's an attack of the enemy, that's going to cause the enemy to flee. He can't stand to see humility. So that humble action, and I'm not saying that all of a sudden things transform and everything's, wonderful. There still may be some depression, some anxiety that may continue because, God's will for certain things and what that's going to do in our lives, we don't understand all of that, but there is, I can't tell you how many times that has helped. And, now the burden becomes something that I can carry with Christ and with my friends and with Our Lady, who I've, have a devotion to, that it becomes manageable. And sometimes that's all we need. On the side of depression, it's a little different experience. Some similarities, certainly the fatigue is there. Again, if you've ever had the experience of you've had a really long day, you're exhausted, you're sitting on the couch, you need to go to bed, but you're so tired you can't get up and go to bed. Imagine that all day long. Everything that you feel like you need to do is too difficult to get up and do. And from the minute you wake up until the end of the day. So that's part of it. Brain fog and thinking slower are really common with depression. It's just everything seems like it's, you're moving in slow motion with everything moving faster around you. There's no motivation because every task looks like it's going to take immense effort or it's impossible. The smallest task, should I get the mail? Am I going to put some dishes in the dishwasher? Am I going to do a load of laundry? Am I going to get out of bed to get up for the day? Seems too difficult to do. And the worst part of depression is when you're in that, it feels like it's never going to end. There's a sense where you forget what happiness and joy are. You know they exist, but you can't imagine them. I've had, different, injuries and things like that, doing athletics. As an example, there have been times where I've pulled a muscle in my back where I can barely move. And then a few days later, that muscle, loosens up and I'm fine and I can go back to what I'm doing. I can't imagine what that feels like right now. I know it hurts incredibly, but I can't imagine that pain right now. But the moment it comes back, it is there. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's what it's like. Well, when you're in that depressive episode, that joy is incomprehensible, which is where the hopelessness comes in, because it's like, what could ever replace this? This is the only thing that now exists in my experience, is this darkness. And then when the joy comes back, it's like, even if it's not joy, it's just a lack of that darkness. It feels amazing. But when you're in that, and that's again going back to Saint Ignatius, and he talks about desolation, and it goes for both spiritual and non-spiritual desolation. You need to tell yourself this is going to be over quickly, because the feeling is it's going to go on forever, and you need to keep telling yourself this will be over fast. Now, The reality is fast may be a few minutes, a few hours, a few days, a few months. It may take years, but you keep telling yourself this is going to end soon. Because when we look at all of eternity, it is going to end soon. And having that hope and trust in God that this is going to end, I'm going to be okay. So when someone's having those experiences, again, part of, you know, the reaction, if you know someone that's going through that, is just listening. And it's okay to say, you know what? I don't understand what you're going through. I know it must be hard. And I feel for you. And I'm going to pray for you. Is there anything I can do for you? The answer is probably going to be no. Other than the prayer. I mean, they're going to want the prayer. But all you're doing is making yourself available and showing empathy. And that is tremendously powerful. Because again, just the fact of articulating that someone is in one of these experiences makes that experience lighter to carry. So that I think is really important. Now, getting to what a person can do, I look at it as three ways that you could have a problem. One of those biological. I know that there are certain genetic things in my family that make me predisposed to these things, which means there are chemical biological processes going on that make me more susceptible. In that case, I need medical help. Going to a doctor is important, and I have, gotten help, through the doctors that I've seen. There are times where this can be caused by psychological aspects. If that's the case, a pill isn't going to fix the problem. You need psychological help from a counselor. And there are times that it's spiritual. And if it's spiritual, you need help from people that are close to God, in particular a priest. You need the sacraments. You need to go to confession. Confession is unbelievably powerful. But confession is not going to fix a chemical imbalance in your brain. And a pill is not going to fix the fact that you have a sin that you haven't confessed, or that you have a psychological trauma that you haven't dealt with. All of these things need to be dealt with in the right place. And most of us have issues in more than one category. So there isn't a one-stop shop usually. And there certainly isn't a single solution for everyone. So getting the proper help and realizing that it is not a sign of weakness to get help. God made us weak. God made us so that we need the help of others. If none of us needed help, we would have no opportunity to ever exercise charity and love. We are made in a way that we don't have what we need. So if you're struggling with this, or struggling with something else, something completely different, there's a chance, and probably a pretty good chance, you're not strong enough for that. But God has placed someone on earth that is there that can help you through that, both for your benefit and for their sanctification. So this is something where getting help, there's a stigma attached to, do I have a mental illness? I don't want anyone to know that I have a mental illness. Almost every person I know that I've, shared my story with has then shared back, oh, well, here are my problems. Trust me, you're not alone. Almost everyone has something they're struggling with. And that is not something that should embarrass us to a degree that we don't seek help and we condemn ourselves to that suffering. But we need to share that appropriately with the people that can help us and get that help.
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting. The virtue that you brought up earlier was humility. I'm like, yeah, it does take humility to get help. But I think another thing that that's going on is, you know, we don't really like to admit to ourselves that we need help. We don't want to admit to ourselves that we are weak. But we also don't want to admit to ourselves, like the realities of where we are at some points. Like I could imagine somebody just saying, I can't actually admit to myself that I'm actually this depressed or I'm actually this anxious. And the thing is, whether you admit or don't admit, share or don't share, reality is reality. And I think we kind of have this nominalist culture where we think that when we can rename things, reality changes, but it's not true. And in the end, what matters is, okay, wherever we are, what step do we take from there? And it matters the concrete, actual changes that we make. It matters that we get medical help if we need it. Or if we're living an unhealthy lifestyle, that we try to remedy that. That if we have a psychological problem, yeah, we have to deal with that. And if we have a spiritual problem, we have to identify that. And we have to take those actions irrespective of whether or not we admit it to ourselves or not. And it's a lot easier if we do.
Absolutely. And those times, it's amazing how the enemy will create fear. When I had to, you know, resolve to come back to the church and do it right, you know, not, you know, show up to mass every now and then and consider myself back, but actually come back. It was like, I'm going to have to go to confession. And there were a list of grave sins that, you know, I'd been away from the church for, I don't know, what it was, 10 or 15 years, and had bought into a lot of the lies of our society. So without getting into the sins that I specifically committed, sure people can imagine, and that imagination probably is not far from the truth. But I made the resolution of I'm going to go back to confession. So I called up the because I knew it was going to take a while. It wasn't a Saturday afternoon at you know, 30 minutes before mass confession. I made an appointment to see the priest, and I put it out like 3 weeks because it was like it didn't feel like it was going to happen in 3 weeks, and I could deal with that. And then all of a sudden I was a couple days ahead, and now the terror was there, and it was terror. And I wrote out pages. The confession took an hour and a half, because I did not want to leave out pieces that really I felt great shame for having done, and wanted to do it right. And so that general, you know, that was a general confession. And I can't tell you the joy that I felt coming out of that confession. I wish everyone had that joy, and could see that. And so many people haven't been to confession in so long and they're scared of it. Go through that fire. It is humiliating to tell a priest, you know, yeah, I did this and I did that and I knew this was wrong and I did it anyway. And then I did that and that wasn't enough. So I got worse and then I did this. And sharing that journey. And now I'm at a point where I just beg our Lord to forgive me. Hearing those words of absolution and knowing that they were real, there is an incredible joy and power in that, that is, you know, you have to do it to experience it. But that fear of going in, I remember. And what I have to say is don't be afraid. You're going to be afraid anyway. I know it. Because me telling you that doesn't change it. You're still going to have that fear and anxiety. But what you can trust is it's worth it. And the power, the spiritual power of that confession will change you. Will it take every problem away? There are problems that, you know, if you're behind on your mortgage, going to confession isn't going to pay it off. But God is going to help you in ways that are unbelievable.
You know, my first confession, you know, when I converted, I set up an appointment and it also took an hour and a half. And I had 10 pages of notes. And halfway through, I offered to order Father Rollo a pizza. Because I'm like, there's more. So, yeah, and it was certainly scary. You know, my brother describes confession as the devil is accusing you of all the things you've done, saying, you know, you've sinned, you're awful, you've done all these things, and he has power over you in that regard, through that accusation, through trying to tell you that about yourself. And confession is a place where you call his bluff. You say, oh yeah, let's go tell God together. Like, you're coming with me, buddy. You and your lies are going to be in the confessional. Let's go ahead. Let's tell God about my sins. Let's lay it all out there. Let's him sort it out. And that's powerful. You know, we also call it the sacrament of reconciliation, or the sacrament of penance. And I found that penance is, I mean, this is something which is not practiced terribly much in the church today. But, you know, I was telling the folks in RCIA, the two most common commandments in all of Scripture. One, praise the Lord, and the other is do not fear. And the first one, it makes sense. Praise the Lord, you can do that. You can sing, you can sacrifice, you can feast, you can do all those things. We understand how to do that, but do not fear is kind of tricky, how exactly you obey that commandment. And psychologically speaking, turns out there's a great way to get over phobias, and that's repeated exposure. You just see a diluted form of what you're afraid of again and again and again. If you're afraid of snakes, you start with a worm and then you build yourself up and you face the fear again and again. And I think that's what we have in penance. We're afraid of pain and we're ultimately afraid of death. So we take on fasting, particularly here in Lent. And it's just a diluted version of what we're afraid of, ultimately, pain and death. And it allows us to slowly overcome that fear. And some of the times that we're anxious about things, like, and it can be something, but sometimes there's no cause, but sometimes it can be something small. Well, if you've cultivated that spirit of penance, you say, okay, if that bad thing happens, I'm not afraid of it anymore. You know, you've met that again and again with that spirit of penance. And that's something that requires grace to build up, because it can also go the other way if you're not fortified, particularly by God's grace in this respect. You can become more fearful if again and again you're exposed to things you fear. But if you're strengthened in the sacrament, then you're propelled to actually do penance that can build up that resilience.
Absolutely. And it is something that you build strength in this that, and maybe strength isn't the right word, but going back to that proper thought process that we talked about towards the beginning, if you are so attached to your passions and desires and feelings, then the anxiety and depression have an anchor hold on you. But once you start to detach yourself from how you feel and you drive yourself from your intellect, now all of a sudden it's okay, I'm going to do this and I feel good about it. I feel lousy about it. Doesn't matter. I'm going to do this. And it gives you a power to live your life that you might still have some of that darkness. And you might still, I mean, Mother Teresa is known for that dark night of the soul for what was it, 30 years? And yet, during that 30 years, her work ethic was off the chart. I mean, she would get up at what was it, 4 a.m.? And hours of prayer, hours of service to the poor, running the missionaries of charity and work until late into the night and then get up at four and do it all over again, at a very old age. And she had the energy to do that in a period of spiritual darkness because she was so aligned with her purpose that how she felt didn't turn her away from the work. And that's part of the journey of carrying these type of crosses, is that you learn, okay, yeah, it's, you know, it's like having a weighted vest on me and everything's more difficult. And yes, I'm going to move a little bit slower and I'm going to struggle through this, but I can still live my life for God, live my life for my family or for whatever vocation, you know, I'm in. You know, a priest, I can't imagine the isolation of a priest where you've got so many relationships in your congregation, but they're always relationships at a distance. Or, well, maybe not always, but very often at a distance. And that for many priests, to have a friend that you can confide in, I mean, I look at it at work. I have associates at work that I get along with. Some of them I would consider friends, but you know, I can't confide certain things in people I manage. Because that's just not appropriate as a manager and a, you know, subordinate. With a relationship between a priest and a parishioner, there are certain things the priest just can't share about themselves, usually. And that has to be a very dark and isolating thing to deal with at times. At other times, there's an incredible joy because of what the priest is able to bring. But you know, there are so many vocations that, well, every vocation has its periods of darkness. And knowing that, and knowing that persevering through that is what God is calling us to, is really important. And that there is a joy on the other side of that that is so incredible. You know, it's worth the struggle. And the struggle, you know, you go to that competition, that Super Bowl of wanting to compete, you know, put your body on the line and suffer through to achieve, you know, for, you know, a football victory, something that's truly insignificant when you look at eternity. We have the chance to do that for things that are significant for eternity and suffer through. And you know, that doesn't mean I enjoy suffering. I still don't like to fast. I still don't like, you know, being depressed or being anxious or any of the things that, you know, go along with that. But I can accept those in a way that I couldn't before. And that's taken years of, you know, as you said, exposure therapy and confronting those things and hitting them head on, and trusting in God. That's so important, is trust. You know, I think that's one of the reasons that God sent us Faustina, 75 years ago, 80 years ago, what are we, 90 years ago, something like that. Because he knew that we were going to be in a time where we needed trust and hope. And we're in that age right now. And he's given us already what we need.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily see that the type of pain from these things, they might not seem to be productive, but I like that you gave the example of that saint who, yeah, he suffered his entire life. We find out that Mother Teresa, she was incredibly productive, but that pain wasn't wasted. God saw that, God knew that, and God understood that her work was that much more infused with love when she lost those consolations of joy. And yet she persisted. So, I mean, the wonderful thing about being Catholic is that pain isn't dumb or useless or meaningless in light of the cross. It's something that we can join with Christ's sacrifice. And principally, when we're receiving the Eucharist, that's the privileged time where we can, you know, call on God and say, hey, these are the things from the week which I had to carry. And that's a powerful and sacramental thing that we're privileged to have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, if you want to wrap up with anything else you would like to have people know, particularly those who are struggling with anxiety or depression, or people who who know people, who love people who are. What's kind of your final word to them?
I think, you know, today, you know, we had the scripture with, you know, Jesus meeting with Elijah and Moses on the mountaintop. And Elijah is, his story is just amazing. He has, I mean, there's so many things in his life, but you look at, he defeats, you know, the prophets of Baal, and then Jezebel orders him to be killed. He runs out to the desert and he prays for God to kill him. He is so depressed and without hope that his prayer is to lay down under a broom tree and pray for death. And that darkness of depression being so bad of, I wish my life would just end, that this pain could stop. Elijah, who is sent to converse with Christ on the mountain, as Christ was walking towards his cross, Elijah had that same depression and despair and hopelessness. And what did God send? He sent an angel with bread and told him to eat. You know, obviously prefiguring the Eucharist. And Elijah walks for 40 days and then encounters God. But he only gets to see the very back of God, only the smallest part. And then, you know, how many centuries later, finally Elijah is brought to the Mountain of Transfiguration, where Christ is conversing with him and Moses to strengthen Jesus and his resolve, I'm sure. Mm. But Elijah finally gets to see the face of God in that moment, centuries after his, you know, his, you know, his end, not, yeah, not death.
Yeah. That's incredible. Yep.
And, but so when you are in that period of despair and anxiety, know that even one of the greatest, perhaps the greatest of the prophets, had exactly the same experience. And God was with him through that and loves you every bit as much as he loves Elijah and he loves any one of us, and that he is with you. You just can't see it or feel it right now.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much, Gary. I really appreciate the things you shared, and I hope it's helpful for listeners. I'm sure it will be. And if you know somebody who would benefit from hearing what Gary just shared, then certainly send it over to them. Gary, thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me.